This meeting of the House Committee on Rural Policy, this, I guess it's the 15th?
18th of February.
It's moving along so quickly, it's always hard for me. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing, informational hearing, or meeting. So I'll open the informational meeting, and we'll invite Marvin Brown to come up and give a presentation. Dick, do you want to come up at the same time? You might as well.
How you doing? Good.
Thank you, Chair Roble, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry, and this is a big issue in the state, so I'm pleased to be able to provide you a little information. You should have got a handout that was prepared for this evening. It's about three or four pages. The things I want to cover in there are, first, just to get everybody on the same page as to the scope of federal lands in Oregon. And if this is obvious things that you already know, I apologize, but I think it's always good to kind of put in context just how much federal land there is in Oregon. Talk about some of the issues that relate to having federal land in Oregon, and talk about the state actions that are ongoing with respect to federal lands in Oregon. So that's what I will cover. In terms of scope, as I said here, there's about in total 30 million acres of forest land in Oregon across all ownerships, and within that 30 million acres, about 60% are owned by the federal government. 16 million acres are owned by the federal government. That includes about 2.2 million acres of ONC lands that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management, and Dick is going to cover their planning progress on those lands, so I won't go into a lot of detail there. It also includes 11 national forests that cover 14.3 million acres. That's a substantial amount of land. And that 60% jumps, actually, if you just look at the percent of forest land on the eastern side of the state, on the eastern side of the Cascades, it jumps to 72%. So it's extremely significant over on the east side of the state. And just to give you a little comparison there, the state Department of Forestry, my agency, we manage less than a million acres, about 3% of the state. So federal lands obviously are very significant here. Historically, and by that I mean before 1990, the federal lands in Oregon were harvesting between 4 and 5 billion board feet per year, and that was in a state out of the state total harvest in Oregon of on 8.5 billion board feet per year. The top of that second page, there's a chart there that shows how that has changed over time. And the reasons, just to explain the chart maybe first, the top line is the harvest of timber across all ownerships in the state. The dashed line is the harvest of timber from privately owned lands in the state. And the heavy line that's along the lower side is the federal harvest from federal lands in the state. And so you can see, in general, for quite some time, private land harvests have been fairly consistent and, I'd say, quite sustainable at the level they're at. And the bottom has fallen out of the harvest of timber from federal lands, and that has, in the end, made a significant difference in the total amount of timber that's harvested in the state. You can track this downward curve starting in the early 1990s. The Northwest Forest Plan was approved in reaction to the listing of the Northern Spotted Owl. It applies to all the Forest Service and BLM lands that are in western Oregon, plus some lands in Washington and California. And it essentially put a substantial number of constraints on the harvest of timber on those properties. At the same time, following, I don't know, maybe a year or two later, eastern Oregon forest lands were also placed under substantial constraints by what was called the East Side Screens. And among other things, what the East Side Screens did was make it almost impossible to harvest any tree over 21 inches in diameter. The even with all those constraints, the Northwest Forest Plan called for a harvest in Oregon of 711 million feet, and the annual sales quantity for the eastern timberlands, the lands that were not part of the western part of the Northwest Forest Plan, had an allowable sales quantity of 500 million feet. That's over a billion board feet of federal timber that conceivably could be harvested in Oregon. But as my note there says, those lands have almost never passed 350 million board feet of actual harvest in any given year for quite some time now. So they are far short of even what's authorized under those constraints brought on by the Endangered Species Act. As a result, now Oregon's total harvest in the states hovers around 4 billion feet, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. You can, you know, attribute causality however you want, but the numbers are the numbers. Since 1992, we've gone from 263 sawmills in the state to 125 sawmills in the state. We've gone from an employment in the forest industry of 57,500 to 42,500. And interestingly enough, I was talking to a bunch of high school kids at a career day last week and telling them that Oregon has some of the most productive forest land in the world. You know, not in the Northwest United States, not in North America, but in the world. Oregon has some of the most productive forest lands there is. And when our mills are running at normal capacity, we have to import about 500 million board feet just to be able to provide wood to those mills. And that wood's come primarily from Canada, but it also comes from Alaska, comes from some from New Zealand even. And that's I think that's a fairly telling situation. And another interesting thing that happens is in a place like eastern Oregon where federal lands so dominate the landscape, when the level of harvest dropped to the extent that it did and the infrastructure started to go away to the extent that it did in eastern Oregon, it has made it much more problematic for the private landowners that remain there to be able to manage their lands for timber harvest. People who used to have a 50, 75-mile haul to take their logs to a sawmill now have a 250-mile haul, and the economics of that are making it very difficult. That plus the fact that a lot of those lands were harvested very heavily when federal timber sales first started shutting down. They tried to shift a lot of that supply to the private lands, and they were harvested very heavily, and actually seeing the ability of those lands to produce less right now because of those essentially over-harvest that took place for several years. Some other numbers. Again, you know, you can attribute causality however you want to, but in 1999, there were four counties in Oregon whose 15% or more of their population was below the poverty line. In 2004, that had gone up to nine counties in Oregon whose 15% or more of the population was below the poverty line, and all those counties are in traditionally forest-dependent type rural areas. And you all are very aware of the funds that have been coming into the state from the Secure Rural Schools Act. That amounts to about $282 million. That's going away. That money originally was generated from revenue sharing that took place with federal timber sales. The Secure Rural Schools Act was meant to replace the revenue sharing with a straight allocation. And it did that for several years, but that has sunset now, and that was the level of economic support that's moving out of the system now. And it isn't just the funding cuts to counties and things like the Secure Rural Schools Act. Management of federal land is, by and large, been underfunded and reduced in funding during the same period of time. I was talking to the supervisor of one of the national forests not that long ago, and he was telling me that in the late 80s, his national forest had 850 employees. They now have 230 employees. that just goes to show you the level of funding cuts that have taken place. And when those kind of cuts are implemented, it hasn't been just timber, but it's been the recreation economy and a whole host of other values that federal lands deliver that have suffered. They closed campgrounds earlier. They closed campgrounds permanently. Same for trails. Roads are a serious issue on federal lands. Where we work really hard on, say, our state-owned forest land to eliminate all of the fish passage blockages that exist on old roads, that's still a problem that's huge on federal lands. And they simply have not had the dollars available to do road maintenance, road repair, and road upkeep that really is the standard in Oregon for state and private lands. They have significant problems with sedimentation from old roads that are not maintained, as well as a lot of fish passage blockage that still exists out there. You can, kind of move to what are the federal lands all about, and clearly the intent was to put an emphasis on biological values for those properties. And there's nothing wrong with that. Biological values are extremely important. But even in doing so, you can see here that on the three sort of marquee species, spotted owl, coho, and marble murrelets, there really hasn't been a significant success story with any of those, even given the amount of land dedicated mainly to producing the biological kinds of values that would support those species. The impact on federal lands to private lands is pervasive. Pretty much any part of the state, there's an ongoing concern on the part of private landowners about the manner in which fires are fought and leave federal lands and move on to private property. There's similar health issues with insect and disease infestations moving from federal lands to private lands. There's if you look at the amount of acreage that should be treated on federal lands to kind of get them back to some healthy ecological condition, that's proceeding at a rate that's about 10% of what it should be. And that gets compounded every year because once an acre is treated, you need to go back and continue working on it over, within another 5 or 10 year period as a rule. I think it's notable to say that just about every time there's been an evacuation of communities in Oregon in the last 5 years, it's been from fires burning off of federal property. So, I don't... setting it up nicely for you, I'm sorry. Just in terms of state actions, we've got a really long history of working with the federal government on fire protection. We work very hard to try to make that a seamless fire protection system. We share resources readily. We cooperate. We train together. We adopt the same standards. We actually protect under contract most of BLM's Western Oregon property, the 2.2 million acres, and that works. That's, a very successful contract on everybody's part. And I would like to explore doing that on Forest Service property because I think there's a chance that by spreading our function over a larger number of acres that conceivably we could reduce the cost per acre that we now have to charge private landowners. By adding in some additional critical mass to the whole system there. We haven't done that yet. We've had discussions. We're a long way from getting some agreement to do that, but I think it's something that's worth trying. Through the National Fire Plan, we've had a real good history of cooperating on the development of community wildfire protection plans within places around the state that also implements Senate Bill 360. That dealt with trying to identify measures that communities could use to protect themselves in the wildland-urban interface from wildland fire. In 2005, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1072, which was an expression that you all felt it was important for us to engage heavily in federal land issues and reference specifically opportunities, trying to expand opportunities around biomass and around stewardship contracting, but trying to get to be more directly involved in vegetative management activities on Forest Service land. And we have been doing all those things to the extent that we have the capacity to do it. The governor has done several things related to federal lands over time. He has signed memorandum of agreement with the BLM and the U.S. Forest Service, which makes the state of Oregon a cooperating agency on all their planning activities. That essentially embeds us onto their planning teams and makes us an integral part of developing those plans. The Department of Forestry has taken the lead in trying to coordinate 11 state agencies altogether who are involved in providing input on those plans. BLM's work, as you'll hear here in a minute, is pretty well along. The Forest Service has not really been able to get off the mark yet because they've had a lot of controversy around the planning rules they've been trying to develop. The governor also asked the Board of Forestry to create what he called a unified vision for the role of federal lands in Oregon. And the Board of Forestry, in doing that, went about creating what they call a Federal Forest Advisory Committee. And this Federal Forest Advisory Committee is an extremely diverse group of people. It felt like if we wanted to have any chance of creating a unified vision, we were going to have to embrace all the different views we possibly could about federal lands. And that group has environmental interests, conservation interests, forest industry, county government personnel, the key agencies, Department of Environmental Quality, Fish and Wildlife, and ourselves. And they're actually coming together and having some success at identifying what the common problems are. They hope to deliver a set of recommendations in June. And we hope that we can use those recommendations then to be more specific about the kinds of things we try to advocate for in the federal plans and also in working with our congressional delegation on federal policy changes. I talked about the loss of the $282 million. The governor has created a task force to deal with that loss as well. One of the subgroups of that group is chaired by myself and Jackson County Commissioner C.W. Smith. And our job is to look at options for making recommendations on federal land management that might have a positive impact on county financial conditions. We've tried to do a lot of these things to the extent that our capacity allows, but actually we have no funding from you all to do any of this, and so it's all kind of on the cuff. I spent all day today working on a request from one of our federal delegate members who's asked for some input on one of the bills they're working on, and that's not funded by you all or anybody. We've got one position that coordinates the work of the Federal Forest Advisory Task Force and tries to help us stay on top of things. So we've had some discussions about ways that we could add capacity over time, and I think that's a discussion we want to have during the next legislative session when it comes to our budget proposals. If we really want to make a difference, we need to have some people in there that are just kind of waking up every day thinking about what can we do about the federal land issues. I'll mention one other thing, and this is something talked to Chair Roblin about way back when. It's still alive and kicking. The National Association of State Foresters, which are all my counterparts around the country, and also the Society of American Foresters, which is the professional association for forestry people, practicing foresters, have both been pursuing the notion of federal legislation that would call for a wholesale look, review, discussion about federal forest policy in the United States from the standpoint of both public and private lands, and thinking that and today when I was doing a little work for one of the delegates, the federal legislation that exists right now is just, it's a mess. It's a morass. It's a, it's so conflicting and complicated, and there's so many pieces of it that run counter to promoting good forestry, and so many pieces that are just, you know, don't apply anymore or not used anymore. And really, if you look at all of that, it seems like somebody needs to get their hands around that and really have a fundamental discussion about what is the federal government's role when it comes to forests in the U.S. And we've been promoting that. The governor was supportive enough to take a resolution to the Western Governors Association that called for that same look, and the Western Governors Association adopted that resolution, so we're kind of working through that, but that's a very long-term long-term endeavor. A couple of pictures here. When I quit, this is what we get concerned about. The top picture there is near Lakeview. And when I was in Lakeview last summer, some folks there said, you need to take a spin out over the, or this one set of roads there and look. This is 80,000 acres that just cropped up in the last year of red, dead trees. And a lot of that property lies within a quarter mile of private land in that area. And this 80,000 acres wasn't there 2 years ago of dead trees, but it is now. And just to give you some sense of scale there, the Elliott State Forest, whom we spend a lot of time and energy managing and doing, you know, some pretty important financial things for the Common School Fund, is 92,000 acres. And this is 80,000 acres that just, you know, up and died pretty much within a year and a half period of time. And if you get up close, this is what a lot of it looks like. So I'm going to stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Do you want to take some questions now before we hear from Representative Brown?
Thank you. Mr. Brown, I appreciate your presentation very much. I'm very glad to see that you have a plan in place to be working with the federal government around these complex issues, and I appreciate very much that you've identified so many of them. My plan, being a fairly simple guy, was that we simply take over the federal forest land. I suspect your approach is likely to be more successful, even though it may take a long time. It is very clear to me that the federal government has mismanaged our heritage for a whole variety of reasons, probably having nothing to do with the people who are presently in the room. But acknowledging that directly up front the way you have, I think, is the first step in actually making things better, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Any other questions at this time? Okay.
Thank you. We may have some more in a few minutes. Sure. But thank you.
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm happy to be here. I am Dick Prather. I work for the Bureau of Land Management. I work out of the Oregon State Office. I happen to live in Salem, so this is kind of convenient. I can just slip down the road here and stop and visit with you. I am the project manager for the Western Oregon Plan Revisions, and that's our jargon for revising our land use plans, which guide our management on Western Oregon lands. This is only Western Oregon. My history with the BLM is... 30 years, I think. Long time. I worked in Coos Bay for a while. I zipped to Idaho for a bit, came back. I've been a field manager here in Salem for 20-some-odd years. I've been around before the spotted owl was listed, after it was listed, after the Northwest Forest Plan, and lots of other things. So I've got a bit of experience working with this, and I guess that's why they wanted me to take on this job of revising plans. So what I'd like to do tonight is just share with you a little bit about where we've been with our plans, where we're going, and some of the differences between alternatives and some of the impacts. And you should have a handout there in front of you. There's some on the side table, but there's a few more. If those back there want some. So we're just going to take a whirlwind tour through this. We currently have our draft out. We finished public comments. That's about a 1,700-page document. So I didn't bring you any of those, and I didn't think we'd go through it page by page tonight, but this is real quick. So federal forest land in Western Oregon. There's national forest land, there's BLM. BLM's about 2.5 million acres, Western Oregon. Of that, about 2.1 million is ONC lands. Now, ONC lands are a very special designation for forest lands only in western Oregon. And it is some of the most productive forest land in the world. I'll agree with Marv on that one. It is amazing. I grew up in Arizona. My forester degree is from Arizona. My first job was in Coos Bay, and I got there, and you can almost watch the trees grow there. It is just amazing compared to Arizona, where if you waited long enough, you'd say, wow, that tree did grow. But it was just, it's unbelievable how productive this land is. ONC, I'm just going to give you a quick thumbnail sketch. There's a handout on ONC there, but it's a little important to know the history just a bit. Building railroads, Civil War era, thereafter, the way the government did that was didn't have money to pay outright, but they granted land either side of the railroad right away. That's the ONC Railroad here, build the railroad from Portland to Sacramento. Our part only went to California border. Another company built it the other way. Granted lands either side of the right-of-way. Had some conditions on those. Had to go to a settler, no more than 250 an acre, and no more than 160 acres. So that sounded pretty good. The railroad company said, yeah, we can pay for the railroad that way. But there was another motive that went along with all of that, and that was the development of towns and communities. As the railroad was built, they built a town that went with it. That's where commerce came, went to the rail line. Roseburg's a great example, but Cottage Grove, a lot of little places you see now, were railroad towns. That's why they sprung up. Roseburg was the terminus of the railroad for a long time, so that became a real shipping center there. The company built the railroad, but selling the land didn't go so well. Why was that? Well, you had to sell it for 250 an acre, had to be to a settler, no more than 160 acres. At the same time that was going on, the Homestead Act was also in place. Now, the Homestead Act, you could get 160 acres, a settler, and it cost you nothing. So, wow, would you pay 250 an acre, or would you get it for nothing? Well, I'll try the nothing route first. The other problem, when you look at most of the ONC lands, they are very steep, heavily timbered lands. You needed a homestead. You needed to live on the land. Well, first thing you had to do was get all those big old trees out of your way, get the stumps out of the way so you could farm. So they didn't do very well selling that land. But timber speculators came along. Timber moving west across the state, across the states, got to Oregon. That land became valuable for timber. The problem was the rules. So at one time, railroad company said, we're not going to sell any more of that land. The county said, wait a minute, foul. That's our tax base. You're going to settle it. People are going to move in. That builds a town. How are you going to do that if you're not selling any? And timber company said, well, we'll buy it. But remember, 1930s, how timber was harvested. Everything went downhill, ran on gravity. So you built the mill at the bottom of a river. Timber fed to that. When that timber was gone, moved to the next drainage, started again. So the counties are saying this isn't really helping build a whole lot of industry here because it keeps moving. Fast as they get there, town springs up, goes next door. So said, what are you going to do? Government, federal government's yours, do something. The government took the lands back. Those became the ONC lands, 1937. They said manage them for permanent timber production. The timber thereon shall be sold, cut, and removed with following the principles of sustained yield for the purposes of providing a sustainable supply of timber, protecting watersheds, regulating stream flow, stabilizing communities and industry, and recreation facilities. That's the basis of the ONC Act. That's the rules we manage under today. So let's jump ahead real quick to the Northwest Forest Plan. Spotted owl got listed. President came to town, said, we got to do something. There's a major crisis here. And that, if I think your chart had the lowest point on there, was after the spotted owl was listed and everybody was enjoying and the federal government was not selling timber at all. So came together with the Northwest Forest Plan. Let's make a plan across the Northwest, not just Oregon, but across the Northwest. And they did. It's a good ecosystem plan, but I think one of the failings of it, one of the reasons we're doing our plan again, it did not recognize the unique differences of the ONC lands. It lumped everything together, lumped it with the Forest Service, who is the major landowner, and the National Forest Management Act. So one of the things we want to do in revising these plans is clarify our authority is the ONC Act and what that means. Another reason we started to do the revisions was when we looked at our plans, we evaluate our plans every 5 years. So we were in our second evaluation. What we found is we were not meeting the goals we set, and the biggest goal we weren't meeting is timber. We just weren't able to offer the amount we said we would. That triggers a plan revision for us. We also had the opportunity to try and coordinate our plan with the recovery plan for the spotted owl and critical habitat for marble murrelet, which are all going on at the same time. It would make sense for the federal government to act unified and figure that all out and come up with one plan that works for all of it. So we thought that was a great opportunity to do that, too. In addition, you've probably heard about the settlement agreement. There was a settlement agreement. We agreed we would revise our plans, contingent on funding, and be done by the end of this year. So that's the fourth piece of that. So let's look a little bit about what our plans are. And we'll just start through this. There's some stuff inside, but we'll get to that in a little bit. So I told you a little bit about, and I'm on XL1V. Anybody knows their Roman numerals?
What do you want?
That's the page I'm going to start on, purpose and need. What we are doing in this plan, we have to have a purpose and need. Purpose and need guides the whole planning process. Purpose and needs meet the terms of the ONC Act, permanent timber production, practicing principles of sustained yield. While we're doing that, though, we have other laws we have to operate under, too. Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, on and on and on and on and on. So we have kind of a tough job to do all that together and come up with something that meets all those laws. Some of the folks in the BLM say we have to balance them. I don't look at it that way. We have to meet them all the time. So it's not really balancing. You can't take a little bit of clean water and get a little more timber. You have to meet them all the time. All of our alternatives are designed to meet the purpose and need. Purpose and need is a key to our planning and to NEPA documents. So let's talk a little bit about the alternatives. I'm on the next page. Some things in our plans are not changing very much. If you look, we have wilderness areas. Congress said manage that for a wilderness. BLM doesn't get to say, nah, let's manage it for something different. Wild and scenic rivers, we have some of those. We have a national monument. A whole lot of things like that don't change. Stay the same. In our plan evaluation, we also found there were a lot of programs that are working pretty good. Our recreation program, special forest products, a whole lot of other things working fine. So there's no sense to change them. We couldn't find any reason to change that management direction. There's no new information. They're working well. They stay pretty much the same. Fire hazard communities, we've engaged in doing fuel hazard work across the state. Dick's personal opinion, not the BLM's, but I do think sometimes a little more money would help that. But we're working on that, too. All right. So what varies between alternatives, then, if those things stay the same? We varied the width of riparian areas. We varied a few other things. It says snags, green trees, downwood, salvaging. Then we also varied habitat, late successional habitat for spotted owls, marble murrelets. So there's really three big pieces that moved around there. A land use plan is made up of land use allocations, an objective for each, and then management action direction to get you to those. So the three big land use allocations that vary are late successional management areas, riparian management areas, and then what we call timber management areas. So through these alternatives, you'll see a variation there. So let's just talk a little bit about Alternative 1. Alternative 1 is based on the Northwest Forest Plan. It keeps the same late successional reserves. We call them late successional management area because we're allowing a little more management in there. Not much, but a little. Riparian management areas are then one half of the Northwest Forest Plan. We just divided it by half. And what wasn't in either one of those then is timber management area. So Alternative 2 then takes on a little different approach. Here we looked at the Spotted Owl Recovery Plan. And you probably read about that in the paper, too. There were two options. The second option in that said, here's the rule set. Federal agencies, you apply the rule set to your land and see what it comes out. BLM did that. That became our late successional network in Alternative 2, applying that rule set. Riparian here changed quite a bit. This one went to 100 feet on fish-bearing and perennial streams, and it went to 25 feet, no activity on intermittent streams. Now, intermittent streams also had a green tree retention along those. In Alternative 2, we did one other interesting feature. We looked and said, large wood comes downhill to streams. Where does it come from? Well, it comes out of a lot of unstable areas. So we tried to identify unstable areas, and we put a 100-foot buffer around those so that we could ensure that we grow large wood on those, so when it does come down to a stream, it's producing large wood. Okay. Alternative 3, then, was a totally different approach. Here we said, how could you do this without drawing so many lines on the map, without the land use allocations? What could you do there? There we said, let's see. Spotted owl marble murrelets seem to like bigger, older trees. Let's use a long rotation. Let's don't have late successional management areas. We kept some riparian management areas for water quality, but other than that, it's one general use area. Manage on long rotations, grow big old trees, at the same time produce timber without having things divided up. Those were the three basic alternatives. So let's talk a little bit about impacts. And I'm going to flip all the way over to L1D. It says timber on the top of the page. It's got four little pie charts go with it.
Page 54.
This is timber quantity. Bar chart there on the right-hand side of that, you can look at sale quantity going across there. No action. Goes up a little bit. We're currently at 203. This goes up to 268. Wait a minute. No action. You're not changing anything, right? How did that happen? When we did the Northwest Forest Plan, it said all streams get a riparian management area. All streams. It said annual scour and deposition defined a stream. So when we looked at maps, we said, we know there's a lot more streams out there than there are on our maps. So we made a sample, went out and sampled, said, how much more are there? Came up with an estimate. We applied that. We overestimated. So now we have mapped most of our streams. We found out there are actually less than we thought. So that gave you a few more acres in the timber base. That cut went up a little bit. Also, our growth inventory, our yield went up. We have not been harvesting timber as fast as we thought, so we've got more growth out there than we planned to have. So that drove you up a little bit. So it's a little more than today, 203 to 268. Alternative 1 then goes up about 450, 470. More timber management area. Alternative 2, 727. Alternative 3 goes up to about 480, 490. Now, in addition to that, I told you late successional management areas, we could do management in there. Management there is as long as you're moving those stands, those areas, to more desirable characteristics for northern spotted owl marble murrelet. In other words, you're creating more complex structure, larger trees in those stands you can continue to manage. Once you've done all you can do for it, you have to quit. So there's a thinning volume, a density management volume that comes out of those areas. When you look at the bottom, you will see this we called it non-harvest based. You can't sustain it. It's a one-time shot. You don't get it again because those areas are managed for those late successional characteristics. So it's one time, doesn't sustain. And you can see there it tapers off over time. But the volume does, it's pretty good for a while there. So you add that to the sustainable volume up above. Now let's translate that. Let's back up one page. Socioeconomics. Left-hand page there, you will see a graph again of timber revenue. It also has secure rural schools payments in it and also has the safety net for owls in it, similar to the graph Marv had. You will see 80s way up, tapers down, bumps up again. The bump up towards the end is secure rural schools, which we thought was going to end, didn't end, got extended 1 year, but now, who knows, we're back to where we were. Is it extended? Is it not extended? Will it be reauthorized? We don't know. The interesting thing to look at are the little bars to the right-hand side. That first real short one is what would happen if there was no secure rural schools in 2005. That would have been payments to the counties. Mm-hmm. Now, you can see the alternatives then go up from there. And if you look at alternative two, it brings you up to 92-93% of secure rural schools. Now, I have to tell you the whole story on that, though. Remember, secure rural schools applies both to BLM and Forest Service. You're only looking at the BLM piece here, about $115 million. The Forest Service, we made no projections here. We assumed it would go away. We looked at revenue that had been produced by Forest Service timber sales. It was very small. If you put it next to ours on there, you wouldn't even see it. So we did not, we counted nothing from the Forest Service side when we did this. So you're only looking here at about half, little less than half of secure rural schools. Okay?
And it's only for those counties?
Only to the 18 ONC counties. So let's talk a little about jobs then and what that does. One of the things our plan does that secure rural schools didn't do is the job side of the equation. So when you look here, now we measured against current jobs. Okay. So you look, no action, and you see 3,770 less jobs. Wow. Well, that's timber being down, but the other big piece is county payments being down. That money to the county goes to support sheriff's office, libraries, buys materials to fix roads, does all kinds of things. The BLM portion of secure rural schools goes to general fund, so the county can use that for what they need. The Forest Service person, part of that goes to schools and roads. It isn't general fund, so they're restricted what they can do. So BLM money gets spread around a lot in the county. That creates a lot of the multiplier effect of dollars rippling through the community. Alternative one, then, timber's up, jobs are up, revenue of the counties are up, so you're only losing about 516 jobs. Alternative two, you're gaining 3,442 jobs. Again, that's timber revenue. That's the money rippling through the county from those. That's the county jobs, money rippling from that. Alternative three, you're losing 1,200 jobs if that one would be selected. Here again, a little less on the timber side, a little less on the county side. You're doing a lot more thinning density management in that one, cost more, so there's less revenue and timber receipts. Okay? All right, let's talk a little bit about habitat for marble murrelets, those kind of things. What we saw, we didn't try and do old growth, late successional forest here. We used four structurally based classes. Young forest, stand establishment, you replanted it, starting. Young forest, mature forest, structurally complex. What we saw across all these alternatives, you get more structurally complex, more mature forest through all of the alternatives. Okay. The Northwest Forest Plan, very interesting, approaches what we thought the natural historic levels would have been. None of the other alternatives do that. But all of them have more structurally complex, mature forest than you have today. So it increases over time. Habitat for marble murrelet, we did see a slight decline in alternative two and three. We've been working between draft and final to see if we can make some correction to those numbers. Spotted owl, habitat for spotted owl under all alternatives increases. All of the alternatives meet the rule set for recovery. Now, there's lots of debate about what that means and everything else, but we do meet that. We have large blocks of habitat spaced across the provinces, no more than 12 miles apart for the big ones, 6 miles for the small ones, and dispersal habitat in between. So we think we're meeting our goals for spotted owl. Fish, all our alternatives increased large wood. Temperature in streams was met under all the alternatives. Sediment was reduced in under all the alternatives. So we think we're doing good things for fish, too. Water, same thing. Temperature, sediment, doing good things there. Fire and fuels. We noticed alternatives 2 and 3. We saw an increase in fire severity and a decrease in resilience in the southern part of the state, Medford and our Klamath Falls resource area. When we looked at that, we said, what's causing that? And the driving behind that is if you look at how those lands developed, what a natural fire regime would have been there, it was infrequent fires, but they weren't very severe. They burnt through, burnt up, created holes in stands, but they didn't really, they weren't stand replacing events. Not like what we're seeing today. We were going in there putting in even aged forest management. So you were creating structure that was ideal for those fires once they started to burn across lots of ownerships. Alternative 3 did not have that, had uneven aged management. We didn't see the same fire results there. So we're looking at that saying, interesting, can we do something in other alternatives that would mimic that? That's a real quick tour through alternatives, through impacts. I just want to wind up a little bit. We are now between draft and final. We had a 120-day public comment period. Started as 90 days, two 30-day extensions. We just finished that. Over 30,000 comments. We are now going through those, finding the ones that are important, ones that we look at and say, wow, that would change something we were planning to do. That's good information. Haven't finished that yet. It'll take a little while to get through all of those. We plan to have our final EIS out late summer. I'm looking August, September. Right now is what the schedule looks like. We will have a new record of decision sometime mid to late November. Implementation then would start probably after the first of the year. So that's where we're headed. I would be happy to answer questions.
The guy who knows very little about federal forest law is about to ask a question about that issue. The plan you're describing sounds structured, that you're working on different alternatives, scientifically based, input from the public, all of those good things. What are the chances when you get the plan finalized and ready to go that you get sued over the specific implementation that you choose because somebody decides that you didn't follow one or more of these piles of federal laws that Mr. Brown referred to?
Great question.
I think he called it a mess, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. Chairman, Representative Barnett, let me see if I can give you a little answer. I know a little bit about forest laws because I only work with some of them. If we meet our purpose and need, our legal mandate is to manage under the OMC Act. So that's really the controlling forest law for us. We also have to meet that Endangered Species Act. That usually ends up going through consultation where we get an opinion whether we do or don't. Clean Water Act, State DEQ, we'll look at that, along with EPA. Right now, I think we're going to line all those up together, and people are going to say, yes, you have a good plan. I can tell you our preferred alternative in the draft was Alternative 2. Our proposed alternative, our proposed decision will look a lot different than that. But I think those pieces will line up. So that everybody's saying, yes, you pass the law test. That will not prevent us from getting litigated. Litigation takes many forms. We have the Administrative Procedures Act, which there, you just look at procedurally, did you do everything you need to do? Sometimes that's a very interesting one when you're litigated on it because things come up you never even thought would come up or you didn't have any idea anybody could even think in that way to make something look like it didn't fit. So that'll be our first hurdle. My job, try and make sure we pass all of those. But we will be litigated, and we'll see where we go. I think we're going to be defensible in court. We have more analysis, more data behind this plan than any plan the Bureau's done.
Thank you. I'll ask a couple.
First, you know, one of the questions that I like just to ask, because I like to know what we talk about this being very productive land, and I recognize that there are multiple different values for this property, but if it were just growing trees and harvesting trees, that sustainable level that you have, the amount produced equals, what could these lands produce if that was the only, that's just my own.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and we analyzed that in the EIS. We did a couple alternatives in there that we called reference. They're not alternatives, they're just reference. But one of them is what would happen if you just grew it. And the answer comes out 1.12 billion board feet.
And so when we look at option two, we're talking about 700 and some billion. Therefore, we are actually growing the forest, which is what you kind of said here. Structurally, it's going to get older at a slower rate maybe than others because you're going to be harvesting more. When we think about it, and people start thinking you're going to be cutting all this forest, do you know where and how? I mean, we know that there's going to be this 100-foot buffer around streams, and there's all these other kind of stuff, but do we know how that patchwork would look as we rotated through those lands, where we'd be harvesting and where we wouldn't during in those millions of acres on alternative two?
Another very good question, Mr. Chair. One of the things we did in this plan, and it helps address your question, but it doesn't totally answer it. We used a model called Options. It's a timber harvest scheduling model. In that, we asked it figures the sustained yield also. How much can you cut and sustain it over time? But it is spatially based. It's the first time we've done a spatially based model. So it looks through our inventory and it picks harvest units. From that, then that's where we get estimates of type of logging, road building, a whole bunch of other things. And what I would say out of that, we're saying that isn't, that's only one way you could do that. There's lots. But if you look at the age classes it selects to harvest, those are probably the age classes we'll work in. Now, you could look at our age class map and say, well, where do those occur? Well, gee, a lot of them occur in this drainage, very few in that drainage. Oh, over here, here's some more. So you can look at it that way and kind of get an idea where the harvest would occur.
Okay. When I, you know, having had it explained to me by some of the BLM and other foresters, when we started looking at 100-foot buffer on each side of streams, especially when it comes to getting large material in streams, part of the issue that they design is that if you have a tree falling, it's got a, and it wants, you want it to hit the stream, part of the time it's not going to hit the stream because it can go 360 degrees. So there comes a point when you get any bigger than that, you've lost any possibility of getting structure into the river. And could you give an explanation of why that 100-foot is better than, say, a bigger or smaller?
Mr. Chair, another great question. If you look across here, Northwest Forest Plan is two site potential trees. That's the height the tree would grow just naturally next to a stream. So that's two site potential trees. And if we follow your theory, the one way out there at the edge, if it falls over, won't even reach the stream. It's a tree length away. The other one would fall over. So one of our thoughts was, let's do the one site tree. Well, now it's got a better chance if it falls over reaching the stream. The other is the 100-foot. We looked at that and said, well, yeah, that captures a lot of trees. Remember I told you in there we tried this debris flow area. So we looked at these areas, and Coos County has quite a few of them when I work down there that just have a tendency to slide down the hill, whether anything happened there or not. They contribute a lot of large wood to streams. So in those areas we said, let's manage the timber along those to produce large wood. So when those areas slide down the hill, it will bring large wood to the stream. Now, the other thing that we did do, we worked with PMW, some folks there, to look at large wood modeling. Where does large wood come from? How does it get to stream? So we have a model that's actually looked at that I think is finally... That's in review now. So, but it's something we're using here. We're trying to model large wood. How does it get to streams? Where does it come from? How much can you expect? So another thing we've done in here that you could look at.
Okay. Another one that I thought was from my perspective, gave some good information, is that sediment issue and stream water quality. So the research that I understand for the 100-foot buffer does those two things about as well. I mean, we have a place where you're not going to disturb the ground. You also put a 25-foot buffer on the other ones where you're not disturbing the ground, so that stuff that's coming off of where you've cut is hopefully going to get stopped. Have you done the research to indicate that that would continue to keep water quality good and temperature as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have looked at the literature on that. I think you're going to see a change here as we looked. It seems like 10 meters is better than 25 feet, so you're
right.
You've got 7 more feet or something there. But that literature says that that will filter sediment. Now, the 100-foot buffer, we could do some operations in there again if you're going to create, if it would improve water quality or fish habitats, you could do some things there. There were some shade requirements in that that kept stream temperature where you want it.
Other questions? I guess the other thing that I appreciate Marvin's issue of talking to the federal government. My look at federal forest policy is that it puts BLM and Forest Service at real disadvantage because there really isn't a federal policy. There are a lot of federal requirements, but there is no federal policy. And if you have any ideas, I know it's probably you can't really speak to it, but any ways in which we can help people understand that they really do need to have a policy and then arrange around those policies the laws that are governing it so that you guys could manage it easier, let us know if we can help push that. And I know it puts you in a weird place right now.
Mr. Chair, that would put me in a kind of a strange position. So maybe if you want to talk about that, we'll do that later.
And I'll talk to Marvin, too, to talk to some of those kinds of things.
If you do have further questions, this one sheet here, flip back to the middle. You'll find our website. You'll also find my name and phone number there. So if you've got questions, pick up the phone.
Okay. The last one I have is that we did have the Ninth Circuit ruling on the ONC lands, which kind of part of that was the fact that we had to do this plan. Is it your opinion that any one of the plans would meet the requirements of that, or do you think you could end up back in court? I look at the fact that only one of the alternatives, the two which you acknowledged you were leaning toward, is the only one that actually produces the kind of revenue and jobs that I think the counties and others were looking for as an alternative to the payments coming in. If one of those isn't selected, do you see that issue with the Ninth Circuit still there? Do you see these as meeting the requirements?
Mr. Chair, the Ninth Circuit ruling, there's a few of them, but I think the one you're referring to is the Headwaters decision, which said ONC lands are timber-dominant use.
Right.
We think all three of the alternatives meet that decision. Now, there is some debate with others about whether they do or not. The settlement agreement itself said we had to consider at least one alternative that minimized reserves down to those necessary to avoid jeopardy, and that whatever we select has to meet the Ninth Circuit Court decisions. So we think all of them took us down to jeopardy, but I don't, you know, where is jeopardy? Can you draw a line and say, gee, one less acre and you'll jeopardize the existence of spotted owl? But we think all of them, we reduced it. You'll see differences in acres between them. So you could look and say, well, gee, this one does something here. That one did better there. That's the job we have now between draft and final and making a decision, is teasing out those little pieces, putting together in our proposed alternative, our proposed decision.
I don't know if you want to have more conversation or not, Mr. Chair.
We could.
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking about as we're listening to these two presentations and listening to a very complex matrix based on federal law, and I think it was your comment about there being no federal policy, there's a bunch of requirements but no policy, is that as we look at, or as we learn more about these plans, as we look more at what the what you're doing in response to federal law and what Mr. Brown is doing in response to both the state and federal laws as they apply to the lands that he manages. I think it's obvious that we've been in a political deadlock for some time around exactly the issue that you, Mr. Chair, raise. And we are being managed in the sense of policy by a legislative branch of government that is 2,500 miles from here, as the crow flies, with only a small amount of representation from this area, and where it's very difficult to get anybody's attention for very long to any of the things that need to happen. And yet that absent-minded kind of fuddy-duddy guy owns most of the land in Oregon and manages big chunks of it. So it feels to me, if you don't mind a metaphor from the psychologist, is that we're dealing with this old guy, 200-plus years old now, whose mind isn't functioning very well, at least his attention doesn't get over here very often, and who doesn't think very deeply about issues that both of these gentlemen struggle with all the time. And the result is that conditions overall continue to deteriorate. That's my impression as to what is actually happening here. It's sort of like going into a house that belongs to a 90-year-old couple who used to take really good care of it but aren't able to anymore and don't notice that things don't work very well anymore in their place. Only this is even worse because this is a rental property that's 2,500 miles away from where that 90-year-old, or in this case 200-year-old, man actually lives. I think it's of great concern to the state of Oregon. I don't know what to do about it. I appreciate the fact that the BLM is trying to build a plan that conforms to all these, I think the word was requirements that you used. I have to admit that I'm not very optimistic about their capacity to do that in a way that doesn't generate 10 years worth of lawsuits, which puts the current proposal in a position of where it's obsolete. I know in my district, there is BLM land, ONC land, that was planted 35 years ago, overplanted probably, that the foresters from the private land next door tells me could be thinned to produce a substantial amount of marketable timber, that somebody would be willing to pay for that timber, and yet nothing has happened. These issues concern me a lot, which is why I came up with my simplistic idea that we should simply take it over and manage it ourselves, outside of the federal restrictions, with the possible exception of the Environmental Quality Act or the Clean Water Act, and otherwise manage it ourselves. Now, admittedly, that's simplistic, probably isn't going to happen, but if the federal government doesn't get off the dime and start doing running a management plan that makes sense for all of the various purposes that we have, I think that the impetus, at least in Oregon, for self-help will increase. That's a comment. And may I also add that based on what you've said tonight, my impression is that you're doing your level best to comply with those federal requirements. I'm concerned that it may not be enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other comments?
I have one.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to Mr. Brown's presentation. I know that the group known as the Governor's Task Force has just been initiated, but I wondered if you could just say a little bit more about its makeup, any ideas, its schedule, anything encouraging at all, keying in on what Representative Barnard just said. We need to get the federal government off the dime. Will this task force help do that?
That's a good question, Chair Roblin and Representative Gilliam. In the end, it is federal lands and federal policy, and we can identify potential solutions and advocate and do all those things, but we don't have the switch that controls exactly what happens. That's an important distinction. Some of the things that, you know, end up being recommended by that group, we just had our first meeting, and it involved several county commissioners and representatives of the county, as well as some folks who are doing some pretty creative things on federal land right now and being successful at it, around thinning, as you mentioned. You know, there's lots of thinning that needs to happen. There's groups that are doing that in what's called variable retention thinning, in a way that a lot of conservation interests find as, you know, pretty acceptable. They're collaborating with those groups and getting good agreements so that there's not as much appeal and litigation going on. And it's, you know, there's those kind of success stories I think we're going to identify and really encourage more of. The problem at this point is they represent such a tiny part of the treatment that needs doing. They're doing excellent work. I mean, they're doing really wonderful work, but, you know, when it's only at a rate of about 10% of what needs to happen each year, and then whatever you do this year, you need to go back and do again 5 or 10 years from now. That's the point where we've got to figure out a way to get more of that kind of work on the ground. And I don't know what all the answers are going to be. The part of the Secure Rural Schools Act created what are called the Resource Advisory Committees, the RACs. Those have, in a lot of places around the state, brought together a lot of common interest from divergent points of view about, you know, how you can promote better management on federal lands. I think we will end up recommending that those, regardless of whether Secure Rural School stays around or not, those RACs need to be encouraged and fostered so that there's more agreement on the ground in local areas. But that's not a very definitive answer, but that's about all our discussions have taken us to right now.
Other discussions? I guess the other thing that from a perspective of a person who grew up in Port Angeles, Washington, and the Olympic National Park was my playground as a kid, and hiking and going all through that area, and watching its change, and my concern that at some point it will catch on fire, and there's so much fuel on the floor in some of those places, it's going to be an interesting fire, kind of like the biscuit. The fact that many of the places I used to be able to go, because of declining money, like you talked about, in the federal government, they aren't any longer available. Many of the sites have been closed off. Others, which you could drive to now, you have a nice long hike to, which means fewer and fewer people are actually getting the experience in some of these natural areas. The roads are getting destroyed, and so they're going off limits, and so we're finding fewer places where you can get into some of these areas. So I have been concerned that not only are we losing the productive parts of these forests with respect to production, we're also losing the recreational value to people who used to be able to do that, and we have fewer people who really know what the forest looks like, and so it becomes a vision in people's mind of what these forests are as opposed to the reality of what they are. And so seeing the pictures you put in here are important, I think, for people, because most people don't get over to the areas where you have these major infestations of disease and whatever, so you don't see all the dead trees. You don't recognize...
I know.
You don't recognize that those are drying out timber stands that are just waiting as matchsticks for the next lightning strike to come through. We have the problem in the southern Oregon with the disease in our oak, sudden oak death. Same kind of problem. If you don't treat it, you got dead trees all over the place that are a problem. And I guess if as many people as when I was a kid were out in those forests, and even the working people who were out there, there's a greater belief you have to save it. I mean, I think we've lost some generations of people who have really taken advantage of being out in the forest and hunting and doing all those other kinds of stuff, and we want to make sure it's preserved. And we have a vision of what we want to preserve, which doesn't exist right now. And that scares me. I appreciate the fact you brought that information, because I think if you had a managed forest where you were thinning and doing all those things, it would be a great place to go visit. And right now, you could barely walk through many of these places.
Yeah. Absolutely correct, Mr. Chair.
And so I worry that sometimes we love things to death, and it's too late when we finally figure it out. And I hope we can have some impact. And I know, I mean, I've worked with BLM people forever down in Coos Bay. They got the branch in North Bend now. Was involved in a couple of different organizations with them that they actually helped start because they wanted to have these conversations. They have professional foresters. They have people who work very hard at the research to try to do this stuff. And they get frustrated, too, when they get a plan and then we have the lawsuits and the other kind of stuff. All trying to do the job that they know they're supposed to be doing, and we're not letting either the science or anything else decide what we should be doing with these forests, and that frustrates me a bit. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate this, because I think hopefully if nothing else comes out of the conversation that we've been having about the rural schools, we may be having a real discussion at some point about what we do with these federal forest lands. And I thank you for the alternatives. Yes.
And one question, because these pictures, of course, are my district.
I never thought of that.
Did a tour of biomass and thinning type thing in Klamath Falls maybe 2 years ago now. And we had a forester say, if these lands were thinned, we wouldn't see this beetle kill. Is it that simplistic?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gilman, sort of. It's certainly, you know, particularly in eastern Oregon, the soil moisture is such that it doesn't support a whole lot of trees per acre. And when you get rural dense stands over there, they're very stressed. And when they're very stressed, then they're that much more susceptible to those kinds of insect and diseases. And if you were actively thinning those stands and taking the number of trees per acre down to levels where they would be historically, those trees would be much healthier and they'd be much less likely to have those kind of insect and disease problems. And just so you make you feel better, there's a statistics I is in my text, but I didn't point it out, that out of the 16 million acres of federal land that exist in Oregon, there's about 13 million that are classified in somewhat that same condition. 13 million out of the 16 million are classified as being overstocked, diseased, or dead to the point where they present a real risk for catastrophic fire. And when they take off, those are the lands that, you know, end up blowing up in a hurry and burning several hundred thousand acres quickly.
That was supposed to make us feel better.
Well, it's supposed to make Representative Gilman feel less picked on. So
more than three-quarters?
Yeah. Oh. And in these pictures, I remember having a conversation. I don't really know the pine forest stuff as well as I know our nice wet forest on the other side, but my understanding was that at times in the distant past, when they were healthy forests 150 years ago, that per acre it was 10 to 20 trees of these pine trees, as opposed to this picture that looks like a lot more than 10 to 20.
Yes.
Per acre. And then there's the other problem in these areas over there where we have another little shrub that used to not be that existent.
Juniper.
Our juniper forests that are a new invention to Oregon. Juniper did not exist in the way it does now ever before because fire took it out and left the forest. But that's not true any longer. We don't have fire, so.
I'm ignorant of the way the forests were managed in eastern Oregon. I know that the Willamette Valley was regularly burned by the indigenous population, so that there are a lot more trees in the Willamette Valley than there were 150 years ago. Lots more. I don't know about the lands that we're talking about here. Do you?
Chair Roblin, Representative Barnhart, I'm not an expert, but The on the east side of the state, the lightning caused fires really increased the frequency to the standpoint of it's not, you know, historically it would not be uncommon for every acre to burn about every 12 to 15 years. But because it burned so frequently and the stands were so thin, it was a fairly fast, fairly low intensity type fire that didn't basically blow up. It burned over the ground vegetation and pretty much left the larger trees alone.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Representative Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had another question about that. I wanted to, if you'd repeat that regarding most of our acreage being overstocked, diseased, or dead. You were talking about the federal acreage?
Yes.
So what was the percentage again of the 16 million?
13.
Representative Roblin and Gilliam, it's about 13 million acres. And I forget the exact categories. When the National Fire Plan was put in place 5 or 6, 8 years ago, I can't remember, they called for all of all the lands in the states to be classified according to condition class 1, 2, or 3. Three are the real severe ones, like the dead trees you see there. They're ready to blow up. Two are not quite as bad, but still have fuel conditions that would lead to fire behavior that outside of what you would expect normally, I guess is the best way to put that. And one are the ones that where if a fire occurred, you would expect fairly normal fire behavior. So the 13 million acre includes class condition 2 and 3.
Quick follow up, if I
please.
I assume, well, I would say parenthetically, unfortunately for Representative Gilman, if it wasn't for mountain pine beetles, he'd probably have no polling information down there at all. But I digress. I am interested in more information on that, and I assume that's available from state foresters.
Yes, sir. Tara Roblin and Representative Gilliam. You mean the better display of the condition class 1, 2, and 3? Sure, we can get that to you.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as a former representative from House District 55, I can assure you that there were 57,014 people in that district in the year 2000.
Just not many in that forest area. Any other questions? Well, I want to express my thanks to both of you for being here today to the committee, and in particular our friends from the federal government. And I personally know how hard the people at BLM work to try to produce both fiber and other things from these lands that they have entrusted to them. And there's a lot of people working a lot of days to try to get things to happen, and it doesn't always work the way we would like it to. And if there's anything we can do to help, we would love to do that. So, again, thanks for sharing your time with us tonight.
Yep. I would love to be proved wrong.
Yeah. Okay. With that, any other questions? Seeing none, we will close our informational hearing and close our...